specifically film. He says that film is the medium that sort of spawns a mass audience. Photography is the medium that starts to disintegrate and shift the original function of private sort of one-on-one pieces of art. So an example he gives is painting. He says that with a painting, it's really difficult to feature it to lots of people, right? So you put it in a palace and some people get to view it sometimes. The reception of the painting is kind of small, almost one-on-one sometimes, and the opinions about this stay within a certain class, you know, like a bourgeoisie or something like that, the people who can afford paintings. But when photography comes in, photography isn't just what we think of photography now, you know, taking pictures of things. It is the mechanical reproduction of images. So things like paintings get put in, you know, picture magazines. They get distributed. Now paintings are featured all over the place. That painting that was in, you know, a palace, everyone can see that now. The interesting thing about that is that it generates a simultaneous viewing crowd. You no longer can only just present it to one person. A whole people are now seeing this and receiving it. This is the sort of photography progenitor to the film audience, right? A film audience is mass consumption, not just in front of a crowd, sure, but the film itself is distributed to many theaters and whatnot. So he talks about specifically, and this to go back more to, this is a good example, but to actually talk about some of the theory here, he says that the value of a work of art kind of exists on two polarities. The one is the cult value of it, and the other is the exhibition value. So we can kind of equate the cult value to the painting in the palace. It has the, for Benjamin, it's more important that it exists than that it's viewed or anything like that. You know, it's a beautiful painting and it's a, you know, it's a piece of, it's beautiful. It embodies something kind of divine. I mean, if we think about statuaries, he gives the example of statues in churches. A Madonna might be covered most of the year, but it's, the important thing is that it exists, and it exists for a ritual function or ritual purpose. Now, when mechanical reproduction starts reproducing these images, there's a distance opened up between that ritual cult function, where the existence and the presence of that work is emphasized, and more to what he calls, on the other side of the polarity, the exhibition value. Now, there are distinct functions that relate to these different values. So with the cult image, it's that it's a presence, whereas, and it's a presence that can sustain various cults. I mean, it's not just the cult of something divine or the cult of the presence. It's the cult of beauty. It's the cult of authenticity. These traditional ritual functions that have to sustain themselves on the physical presence of something. Once you have the mechanical reproduction of works of art, the physical presence of a work of art starts to matter less and less, and the value shifts from the cult image to the exhibition image. And that also correlates with a shift in its function from the ritual function to what he calls a political function, because now you're not just working with a particular cult, or we might say culture. He uses the word cult, but really it means something like a group of people who value something kind of in itself or for itself. But it moves more towards its political function. Now, why is that? Because it specifically has to do with the effects. Now we can focus on the effects of a medium. It doesn't just have to be tied to a particular ritual practice. We can just focus on what art does to people. And one of the shifts that happens, he dichotomizes it between, with film, he dichotomizes film to theater. Now, you can see how those two things are quite related, but the shift of the function is really important. So one of the things that happens with the shift from people viewing theater to viewing a film is that with a theater actor is always presented with an audience. When they're acting, the kind of impulse that the maestro for the actions that the actor takes is the audience. They're always related to a living, breathing audience. But with a film actor, there is no audience there. There's only the camera. Now, this has all kinds of alienating effects on the actor, but the important effect is actually on the audience when the film audience watches it, because now they're watching an actor who didn't have that audience there to react to and to compose their acting, right? They were acting in front of a camera. And what that means for, says Benjamin, is that the audience stops having a relationship with the actor and things like, big personality cults start emerging. We can think of the star, in a way, the film star sort of filling in the image of the actor themselves. But the other thing, too, is that, and this goes back to, I think, the propaganda stuff, is the audience becomes no longer an engaged receiver of a work, but a critic and a judge of a work. They can judge the way that something was done. And the reason that this precludes specifically on the cult value is that you can't ever have like a divine relationship with something you doubt or that you're judging. You know, when God performs a miracle or when something beautiful emerges, you kind of just, it confronts you. But here, the film is always presented to you to scrutinize or critique, because you're always in the position to view it that way, because the actor wasn't acting in relation to your viewing. You can judge whether the actor acted well or badly in relation to the camera. There's that distance that opens up, and so it allows for a mass society to emerge as judging the actors. Now, the other thing about this too is that it requires very little attention to do this. I find this a little bit paradoxical, just to comment on Benjamin's theory a little bit. I do find this a bit paradoxical. I don't know if it's they actually clash. Maybe it can be explained, but I find it a bit paradoxical that Benjamin does say, well, the audience becomes a critic, and yet they also become a kind of inattentive critic. I think it's because for Benjamin, films pace themselves for the audience. It's kind of a buffet that's lined up for them. All they have to do is go through it, you know, 30 frames a second or something. So they just have to sit there and receive it. And in that way, they can be distracted by it. They don't actually have to pay attention to what is going on. And yet, afterwards, they're still presented with something that they can have critiques about or talk about with one another and receive in that exhibition, in that domain of the exhibition value, the way that it appears, or that it appears at all for the mass audience.
Yeah. Really, really articulate, Brandon. Thank you so much. And we've talked about Benjamin before, and I really like how you brought this to the fore. You know, in relationship to what we were talking about earlier, I actually think in a way what you're discussing brings up kind of, at least from the work we were discussing of Chomsky, again, that was Media Control, one of the weaknesses of Chomsky's sort of political media argument, or at least perspective, which is that, you know, Chomsky views things very particularly through a what you might call news lens, as news is basically just kind of information about the world. And again, that news is contorted and, you know, cherry-picked to aid a very particular group. But I actually think that the point that's kind of missed and is more articulated by thinkers like we've talked about before, like Neil Postman or Marshall McLuhan, is that in fact modern media is more about entertainment and the entertaining relation between, you know, the mass audience and the, effectively the product, and that even news media becomes more about entertainment. And as you kind of, as Benjamin, as you kind of hinted at, maybe I'm contorting it a little bit, but basically the relation is made less important. It's made more almost kind of ephemeral when it's just a constant stream of like stuff to be judged and not taken too seriously because there's that aspect of distance there. You know, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I was listening to a lecture by Neil Postman, again, another media theorist, and he was discussing kind of this very point that, you know, modern media, especially over TV, regardless of what's being shown, has this kind of worldwide replicated quality that makes it makes you able to see everything that's going on everywhere. And because of that, makes it highly impersonal. And he contrasted that with, you know, more local, even if it was still national politics done in his example is in the 19th century, where you would actually, you know, when they were presidential debates, his example was, you know, in the 19th century in particular, you would go, the candidates would travel from town to town and everyone would go and sit and listen to the discussions that were literally hours and hours long, very in-depth, very personal, taking questions, you know, this back and forth here, discussing issues for sometimes 6, 7, 8 hours for the whole day. And in that way, from a political angle, that kind of media, I think it's pretty accurate actually just to describe a discussion as a kind of media, that kind of media was very involved, both intellectually, but also personally and locally. And what, you know, modern mass media does is, again, it's sort of by making everyone always there at once, it also makes things incredibly isolated and also very unimportant to any particular individual. And that's the kind of structural shift that I think, to be honest, Chomsky kind of glosses over or misses a little bit, that instead of just being lied to or manipulated, it's less important to like what the information is being manipulated. And what's more important is the fact is that the information's quality has changed so that it's actually the bits of information you're engaging with are actually less important, even if they're about, you know, issues that affect far more people than ever would have in, you know, 1860.
Thanks, Hale. I was essentially thinking the exact same type of thing of Chomsky's work. What makes like the virtuous politician? What is good about a politician that they're missing? Or what is good about the elite that they're not doing? Is it the fact that they are elite? Or is it the fact that they're not doing something that as the governing class they should be doing? And I think that was kind of the problem in my mind, which is that Chomsky actually doesn't really care about the elite. What he cares about is the governing class and whether or not they're fulfilling their obligation to society, so to speak. And the only reason he introduces the concept of elite is because I think he views that as breaking that system. So to filter this all out, we'll see if it works. When you have a good society, a good governing class, those people are interested in what the people have to say. They go out to those people, they talk to those people, they engage in their discussions, and they figure out what those interests are through person-to-person engagement or through written correspondence or through, I guess you could say that the medium of it is direct personal engagement. You're being with the person. You're looking at the person's ideas and understanding where they can. Whereas with mass media, all of that type of interaction is abstracted out, is removed. Now it's a camera. It's not a single person's idea. It's this group of person's idea because we don't have time for individual people's ideas. We have to talk about groups of people because we have a television schedule and, oh, well, we have these criterias and which group of people should present their ideas and they need to present their idea in public and in this way to take care of these advantages and this incentives. And you can kind of see how that breaks the idea that the fairness of a democratic system fundamentally is that politicians actually engage with people and win their favor through personal engagement. I mean, I guess the question then becomes is there a way of reforming mass media so that its medium, the interactions we have, the cultural element of it, goes back kind of to the former system in some way?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's ultimately one that's going to either be solved or not be solved at the level of the actual technology. Because again, what you mentioned was the camera kind of comes in and kicks the delegate out of the way, and the politician acts in front of the camera. They're not actually listening to their constituents when they are speaking or hearing anything. So can mass media, you know, can we go back but just have mass media? I don't know if you can, because again, it goes back to the structure. Something like social media sure seems to have made a stab at that, though. I mean, think about politicians on Twitter. Now, these politicians can go through people's tweets. They can read what people have to think or have to say to them. But I think the interesting thing is, does that make them any more responsive to, or in kind of, we might want to say like in dialogue with their, with who they represent? I mean, you could theoretically read everything that everyone says to you and still fail to represent them. Even if you consider them, you might not bring to the table, you know, when you go to sign bills or pass laws, you might not actually do that. And I think that's a strength of Chomsky's point, is that they might actually go out and be in front of people that are using that medium of face-to-face, you know, social interaction. They've gone back to, you know, to talk to the people in the street or whatnot. But it's that, in a way, they have their interests already predetermined. They sort of bring to you something that you should want. You, if you don't want this, you're like, you don't know what you're talking about. But essentially, the interesting kind of cross section with that between Chomsky and Benjamin is that Benjamin does think that there is like what we might today call like a systemic critique. So for Chomsky, it is the interest of the business class kind of predetermining the interests of everyone because they're in power and they can determine laws and whatnot. That seems a little bit, you know, it can appear like on a surface conspiratorial, but at the same time, it's like so obvious, it's hard to critique, you know, and it just does like seem to be a thing, people lobbying and whatnot. Benjamin has something interesting to say too about the way that, systematic, like the system or the structure of media actually like self-perpetuates. And that's one of the big points that he makes about mechanical reproduction. One of the other functions of reproduction, like of mechanical reproduction, is just to reproduce stuff. It essentially becomes a self-producing machine. And he makes this point in a footnote, but I think it's actually very crucial. He says that if you think about film, if you think about the cost of film, it is so expensive, right? Like shooting a movie can, well, maybe not nowadays because like we all have phones or whatever. And there have been some movies that have been like made on iPhones. But back then, and still even today, if you want to produce the spectacle that captures people in a film, it's going to cost a lot of money. And the way that you fund that is you have a lot of people pay to watch it, right? So in a way, the left foot kind of carries the right here. In order to make these films that are going to be seen by millions of people, they need to be seen by millions of people, and then that funds the film. So there is a systematic, like, if these things don't get reproduced and seen, they don't exist. So it's inherent in the structure of spectacular films to be seen. They have to appeal to mass crowds. And that's what we see today when we talk about, like, mainstream films or whatever. You know, it's like another Marvel movie. Well, of course, because that's what people want to see. You know, you got to go down the list and get what everyone wants or whatever. They're kind of just produced to be reproduced. They fund themselves in that way. And so that's kind of one analog of saying, well, there's like maybe a systematic or a systemic critique of media here, in the way that Noam Chomsky might have a systemic critique of the business, like business interests in politics, the way that mass media figures in the political realm there. I'd be interested to, if you have any thoughts on that, but because there is this like self-perpetuating structure, and I wonder in what way that might factor into politics.
So just rearticulate that as a question. So it's the mass media effect within society and how it affects that politically.
Yeah, what might be the actual political, because we have this self-perpetuating mass media machine, so films have to be seen in order to be made. But does that have any sort of political implications? I mean, when you think about political propaganda is just funded. It gets funded by people who want certain people in power or whatnot, or they like campaign and they have delegates who support
it. This isn't an answer to your question, but you can see the exact same pattern within elected officials. Like, officials that are elected are more likely to be reelected because they have been elected, because they already have a base of support, which they just need to appeal to again. Now, how does mass media synergize with that? I think it synergizes really well, that if you already have a base of support and, you know, you just do a few mass media publications through that base of support every so often, you can maintain your support probably easier as a politician than you could in times past. But that's not necessarily a good thing. That's kind of the issue here with the idea of business interests in politics, or with these technologies and media and their societal and political ramifications, is that we definitely see that they do change society. And sometimes it's in a positive way, sometimes it's in a negative way, but it's really hard to contextualize that without, it feels like, more data or more examples, which I'm just not sure if we have.
With that, I'm conscious of time, but I will add one little point before we end. And I was trying to, as you were speaking, Brandon, I was trying to think about how to articulate this. I think where Chomsky gets things wrong in relationship to what you're saying, it kind of makes me think, honestly, about McLuhan and stuff, is that Chomsky sees the main driving force of the current situation, current political climate, as, you know, basically the wants and arrogance of a particular ruling class of people. And I think on some level, what Benjamin and McLuhan, was particularly in this case Benjamin, point out, is that in fact is actually a function of the technology that they are using, that the system is set up this way, or has developed in this way. Because effectively speaking, you know, how could they not, you know, use it in the way that they do? It's not like they sit there and we're like, oh, well, we could use it to disseminate lots of perspectives and have things really disjointed and all over the place. And, you know, kind of keep some sort of weird, cultic, localized value in political discussion and political media. Or we could, like, not, and, you know, just reproduce the same slogans, ideas, trajectories over and over again. And of course, you know, go ahead. No, go ahead.
The interesting thing here is, or is they could try, and then they'd find out it just kind of gets reduced like a rock in a river down to that same thing that they're going to get funneled to with the sort of logic of the medium that they're using.
Yeah, exactly. That even if you, like, I was kind of thinking about this, you know, we're talking about, you know, news media and particularly political media and stuff, but even thinking about something like TikTok, right, or YouTube or whatever it is, I'll talk about YouTube specifically. YouTube is full of junk. And I don't mean junk as in, like, bad content. Like, there's that too. That's like a second, like, you know, the upper layer of junk. But I mean, like, stuff that was downloaded by AI bots. Stuff that people accidentally uploaded to the platform. Like, there is literally millions, if not billions, of hours of that kind of stuff. How does that kind of thing have any place in the, like, forum of viewing at all? I know that's low-hanging fruit. It's like, why would anyone watch, like, and basically an accidental, like, pocket upload someone made, right? But the point is that, like, there is, like, these sorts of mediums, these sorts of technologies, by their very nature, will favor that, you know, they will purport and favor a very specific kind of content, you know, a 1% of what's out there. And so this idea that we could disseminate, you know, a kind of much broader field within the context of this kind of technology is antithetical to what this technology is about, because it's about picking what's popular and then reproducing that and making it more popular than it already was, and perpetuating that system over and over and over. And so, and this kind of comes back to the propaganda side of things that Chomsky's talking about, where he's like, oh, well, it's advantageous for, you know, the elites and stuff like that. And that might be true, but there's also a side of it that makes me think, well, the propaganda is also advantageous because it's easy, because it's simple, because it's very digestible. And that's what makes it so, you know, fun. We've talked about this before, but, you know, complex political essays about, you know, how one's, you know, how the capitalistic class is taking over one's social function or whatever, like, don't translate well to modern media. And even in older media, like, even, you know, I've been reading quite a bit of the Soviet Union stuff recently, especially early Soviet Union. You know, it's not like everyone was reading Karl Marx in the Soviet Union. It was simple slogans, simple pamphlets, propaganda movies, propaganda radio. That was effectively like the far left-wing authoritarian version of what Chomsky and, you know, his ilk are arguing against. And the point there again is that that's the kind of media that is reproducible, digestible, popular, and self-perpetuating. And that's the important point. And how could it be any other way? A farmhand in, you know, Omsk, Russia is not going to read Das Kapital. That was never going to happen. That's not a thing. And people who were in power at that time knew that too. And so on some level, it's almost as if, yeah, sure, you have people in control pulling levers, but it's also like the system kind of perpetuates itself. I think that's where I was kind of getting away from the conspiratorial element and being more like, there's a weird sort of natural evolution or projection that happens within the system itself. But I'm conscious of time, so I'll have to leave it there for this week's discussion on media theory at the Canadian Philosophy Show. And I've been your host, Hale, and with me has been Brandon and Aaron.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.